Ever wonder if there's more to the movies you love? Do you like to ponder how they got from A to Z? Who chose the plot twists? Why use those characters? Is there a deeper meaning? We're here to explore those questions and maybe learn a bit along the way. VGB Studios proudly presents The Filmlosophers.
What is up? Hello again, and welcome to another exciting episode of The Filmlosophers, the show that likes to get into the real deeper parts of the movies that you love, and even some of the ones you don't know.
That's right.
I am your host, Eddie Villanueva, along with my co-host, Mr. Chad Riley.
Hi.
How are you doing today, my friend?
I'm doing so well. I'm excited because we're about to talk about one of my favorite movies.
That's right. We actually have a great show in store for you. You know, we've been really excited about the coming months, as you've known, listening to the shows and hearing us talk about it. You know that the very well-known movie is coming out next month, and that is Mr. Chad Riley.
That is not Mr. Chad Riley. That is Captain America: Civil War. It is coming out, as of our recording of this, a little more than a week from now.
Yes.
So as a lead-in to what will eventually be probably my favorite conversation of the year, we're actually building up
to it. So far.
Well, I'm saying it will probably be, the Civil War conversation will probably be one of my favorites.
Mm-hmm.
As a lead into it, we're going to cover the first two movies in the Captain America series, one after the other.
That's right, and not just get into the movies themselves, but we're actually going to dive deep and really just break down what is it that makes Captain America such a successful and popular movie and character into the cinematic universe. So you know what, we got a great show in store for you, so just so you know, we're excited. Aren't you excited?
I'm so excited.
I'm excited.
I just said it. I'm excited.
He's
three
excited.
Weeks.
Fly
three
on the wall.
Weeks
are you excited?
Sustained excitement.
Fly on the wall is excited too.
Everybody's excited. The little toys all over the room are excited. The names on the chalkboard wall are excited.
That's true. We are presented by Mingle Media TV, and we are recording live here in sunny Sacramento, California, live at VGB Studios. Check us out and listen to all our episodes on Audio Boom, Stitcher, Libsyn, Player FM, iTunes, and Mr. Corey Vincent actually just let me know, we found out last week, we are actually available also on Google Play. So if you check us out, you go on your Google Play, or if you go to the Film Losters website, there's a link there as well. You can find us in the podcast section. And speaking of Facebook, also you can check us out and like us on and follow on the show. You can
all
follow
of it.
The
just
shows.
Do just all nah. of it. Everything that
you can
possibly
like,
do.
You can like and follow
ha-ha,
the show.
Wow, cry. Well, I don't even know what they're all called.
There's all different kinds of emotions. Also like and follow the show on Facebook and Twitter, facebook.com/filmlosophers and twitter.com/filmlosophy101. And as always, we start the show off with a little bit of movie news.
A little bit.
At the top of our stories, we have today, or essentially when you're reading this yesterday, was,
you're listening to this.
Is,
we won't make these people read.
Of course not.
We use our voices for a reason. Anyway.
Exactly. Alien Day. 4/26, which is April 26th, is considered Alien Day, following in the footsteps of Back to the Future Day on October 21st and the previously announced by still upcoming Ferris Fest on the weekend of May 20th, Tuesday, April 26th has been dubbed Alien Day. This date, 4/26, is a nod to LV-426, the moon where the xenomorphs are discovered in the 1979 film from Ridley Scott. 20th Century Fox helped fans celebrate with a 24-hour social media event that coincided with special screenings across the country.
And they had all kinds of stuff going on.
They did.
Yesterday.
I actually had my phone set to notifications for the actual website. It's Alien Anthology, at Alien Anthology on their Twitter page.
Mm-hmm.
And they were actually sending out tweets showing little video clips of a quiz question. And if you answer the quiz question in a reply with a hashtag alien fan day or something to mm-hmm. those alien days, hashtag something else, that they would actually pick a random winner and give them a prize.
Which the cool thing was, they were posting these things every, 42.6 minutes?
I think so.
To also tie into the 4/26. They went all out. It was a pretty cool fan engagement opportunity, and there were several cities that did the movie screenings that you could get into and see those movies on the big screen again.
And it's really great to see how much more cinema is kind of getting introduced into like the day-to-day livelihood. Like it's only been recently that people have really been taking seriously May the 4th, you know, with Star Wars.
May the 4th.
And then it was a really, and I think maybe it was Back to the Future kind of jump-started it with last year's October 21st, 2015, making that Back to the Future Day. And I'm not too familiar with the Ferris Fest, you know, but I'm assuming that it has
Bueller.
To do with Ferris Bueller's, you know. Yeah. But ultimately, I like the idea of incorporating a lot more cinema type events and cinema inspired events into our day to day lives, because then it gives me more of a reason to watch the movies.
Well, and I mean, quite frankly, these movies that they're doing the events for so far, minus, I mean, obviously you'll have like your Marvel Cinematic Universe marathon option before the newest one comes out, and you can stay there for 14 hours in the theater and watch everything that came before,
which is great,
which is, you know, probably has a little bit of a ripe smell in that theater by the time you're watching the movie you actually want to see, the new one. But aside from that, you've got these different event days and special screenings of films that have not been in the movie theater format, mm-hmm. In a location with the big screen, the big sound, the popcorn, the soda, the, you know, whatever, for 20 or 30 years.
Give or take.
In many cases. So, I mean, number one, you've got people who enjoyed it way back when.
Oh, yeah.
Way back when. a little bit ago.
There you go.
They enjoyed it when it originally came out. They get to see it in that original format again. And then you have a whole new version or generation of fans who get to see it in a theater for the first time.
Yeah. And not just see it too, but they also respect it and they admire it for what it is. And speaking of respecting, a new writer has been announced for the Sherlock Holmes 3, the third installment in the franchise. Robert Downey Jr. announced last week that the long-awaited third movie in the Sherlock Holmes franchise will begin filming this year. But today, the news was not only confirmed, but we also found out that there is a new screenwriter lined up that will be rewriting the script. According to Screen Crush, James Coyne has been hired to rewrite the Sherlock Holmes 3 screenplay based on the original draft by Drew Pearce, the writer behind Iron Man 3.
And more power to him. It'll be very interesting for me. We were talking about this before the show. This writer, James Coyne, and I like to write as a hobby.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully someday it'll go somewhere. But so I'm not going to knock writers ever.
No.
But I have seen a previous project that he served as a screenwriter for. It's a film called Vikingdom. I believe it was released on Sci-Fi Network sometime last year.
I don't remember, but I do remember seeing it.
It was very interesting. It definitely had quite a few bits that were ambitious and probably over ambitious for the budget that they had for the film.
Yeah.
Which is why some of it felt a little bit, you know, zanier than it had to or than it could have. So it'll be interesting to see what he does. I mean, there's obviously some good-natured humor and different exploits that happen in these Sherlock Holmes films.
Yeah.
The Guy Ritchie series with RDJ and Jude Law and the like. So it'll be interesting to see, now that he's writing on a big-budget movie that has a certain pedigree and a certain style already established, does it feel, I want to say, maybe a little more polished than what I saw from this writer previously.
Mm-hmm. And that's the big question, especially with a lot more writers that are coming up that have previous stints, because it's not to say that it's any less of a quality, less higher quality, I guess, but a lot of people who are having their starts in sci-fi or starts in TV movies or even the indie circuit, a lot of them kind of have that cheese factor that just you can't really wash off. You just, you know, you see it and you're like, all right, this is a B movie.
Sure.
And a lot of them are making those leaps and those bounds into things like, you know, movies that have a established franchise so far.
Well, and to be fair, any movie is a massive collaboration. Even small movies, even short films involve dozens of people usually who are collaborating to make it what it is. So, you know, it doesn't rest on anyone's shoulders. It's really common nowadays to kind of, you know, exalt the main stars and the director especially for a film. And to a certain degree, yes, they may have more say than other people on the team. But yeah, you don't get a movie made and distributed, even a B movie on Sci-Fi Network, unless you have a huge group of people working together to get it finished.
And speaking of stars, could the set picks for Guardians of the Galaxy 2 have revealed Nathan Fillion's cameo role? Some set photos from the film were released yesterday that revealed he would be playing a famous actor in the movies. Photos from the Atlanta set reveal not only an Earthbound sequence being shot, but a movie theater with posters for the, quote, Simon Williams Film Festival. Fans will recognize the name of Williams as the alter ego of Marvel's Wonder Man. Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2 will be released on May 5th, 2017. You actually were saying earlier that you actually have a really large opinion about this.
I do. Okay, so here we go.
Here we go.
So, first of all, Nathan Fillion.
Great actor.
Great actor. Fun guy. Loves the, you know, Marvel movies. Loves working with James Gunn. Mm-hmm. He cameoed in the first Guardians of the Galaxy. He was an inmate in the prison where they kind of all five main characters ended up after they had that weird showdown. They got thrown into prison, and then you had the really big inmate who was, you know, wanting to basically claim Peter Quill as his own.
He was going to slather him in Nobby and Jelly.
Yes, and then the rest of them quickly took him down, that guy. So that was Nathan Fillion doing the voice work for that.
Yeah.
And so now we have a different sort of cameo for Guardians of the Galaxy 2. If you don't know about the movie, which you should because it was wildly popular, but if you don't know about the movie, it has a lot of essentially space adventurers, one of whom is originally from Earth, Peter Quill, played by Chris Pratt. Originally from Earth, he was taken off Earth when he was young. And so now we have these set photos from, I believe it's Georgia, where they're filming the bulk of the in-studio sequences. Georgia. And so there's this older-style movie theater in Georgia, got the marquee out front with the lights and everything, and they replaced all of the film posters outside with homage posters of movies that are kind of similarly titled to movies that exist in our actual real world.
Yeah.
And all these movie homage posters are starring an actor named Simon Williams, and then the marquee says Simon Williams Film Festival. In the comics, Simon Williams is a character who eventually becomes a superhero named Wonder Man, who was in his original, you know, creation, he was kind of like a counterpoint to Wonder Woman in the DC universe.
Yeah.
He doesn't have exactly the same abilities, and over time he's had a really interesting story. The reason I have an opinion about this is because I really wanted to see Wonder Man, like, post-Infinity War. I wanted to see him as one of the Avengers.
Well, he plays a pretty large role in the Avengers.
And if you stick this cameo sequence and you stick to it, then Simon Williams is spoken for. And
there you go.
It's all right. It's a character that I do enjoy. He has some unique qualities. He has a really weird history. He was used in the comics as the original mental template for the Vision, which we've seen in the movies, played by Paul Bettany, with a completely, not completely, a somewhat different origin story. Mm-hmm. But in the comics, Simon Williams had been dead, and his mental pattern was saved by Tony Stark in a computer and then kind of imprinted over this synthezoid, the Vision. And so all of Simon's thoughts and feelings toward, for example, Scarlet Witch, now were held by the Vision. And eventually Simon kind of returned and his mind was returned to him, but then the Vision still retained thoughts and feelings. So then they kind of competed for, you know, Wanda's affections, the Scarlet Witch, and other things ensued. More recently, I think one of the far more compelling character arcs that has been done with Simon more recently kind of positioned him as a pacifist. He's incredibly powerful. He's even challenged all the Avengers before when he kind of had a difference of opinion, let's say. And then kind of he came back from that and he said, you know what? Yes, I've got all this power. I could do all these things. I think that fighting is the wrong answer. We keep giving each other and all these people and all these bad guys in the whole world the wrong answer. And I think as a more mature storytelling point, it would have paid good dividends from a story perspective later on in the MCU sequence. But I'm not going to knock them for cameoing Nathan Fillion in this way, because with Wonder Woman taking off so well in the film Dawn of Justice, and probably undoubtedly in her own, you wouldn't want to, you know, jump in that boat in a sense with a character named Wonder Man too soon, or, you know, immediately after that debut.
So that actually draws up a good question as far as the timeline, I guess, so to speak, for Wonder Man in this film. If this is the true thing, if this is something that really is going to come about as, you know, and it's not just like one of those and pass by and, oh, there's this going by, but we're going to keep on going and not focus on that. If this is really a legitimate cameo role that's going to be for Nathan Fillion in this film, do you think that this will be pre-Wonder Man or this is post-Wonder Man?
I think that this will be without any regard for Wonder Man. Mm-hmm. In the comics, he did not become a stunt performer and then movie star until after his transformation.
Yeah.
In these films, especially this is a Guardians of the Galaxy film.
Mm-hmm.
It's not an Avengers film, so there's not really room, I wouldn't think, to tell his story. I think it's more an eye candy thing.
Okay. Well, speaking of eye candy.
Oh, yes.
The final trailer for X-Men Apocalypse debuted with the latest cameo in the film. So this is the final trailer of this film, and it debuted, and at the end of the trailer, everyone went nuts because, you know, you see something unique. Yesterday, we got a new X-Men Apocalypse trailer, and it gave us not only a definitive answer that the film will indeed include Wolverine, but also tipped us off to when he'll probably appear in the movie. X-Men Apocalypse opens May 27th. So who do we see? We see Wolverine.
Well, we see his arm.
We see his arm.
We see an arm that appears to be Wolverine's arm with three claws coming out the way that we're used to them having. You know, I mean, it could always be a tease, but I think undoubtedly, yeah, it's Wolverine.
Now, do you think... This was my issue. I was speaking to somebody the other day, it was earlier today about this, and my issue was everybody got really excited when they heard, oh, Wolverine was going to have a cameo in X-Men First Class.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone was like, oh, it's going to be great. It's going to be this. It's going to be awesome. He's going to be in there. He's going to train. He's going to do this. But nobody really knew the full scope of his cameo or even the length of time or how in-depth he was going to be as far as...
And it ended up being...
Literally, like 3 seconds.
20 seconds?
Not even. They walked in. Will you? No. Okay.
That's true. Yeah, it was really quick.
So... My concern for this is that I'd love to get my hopes up. And after the fact that they've repaired, Bryan Singer has repaired the X-Men universe in this, you know, in Fox's hands, that if I get excited for this, that I might get let down, like right at the end. They're like, oh, and then they just show him like running down the hall. You don't even see his face. It's his back. And he's just holding his claws out on both sides and just killing everybody. And then he takes off around the corner. He's gone.
Sure.
You know, what do you think? What do you think the full amount that they're actually going to be use?
I don't know in terms of amount.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of amount of screen time, it could be small. There are so many characters in this film. There is a lot going on. If you've seen even the trailers before this final trailer, you have noticed how much action there is, how many characters are fighting against each other, and you know, whatever. So duration, I'm not sure that it's going to be super long. Bryan Singer did release I think Empire magazine from Britain released an interview with him kind of commenting on this final trailer, and he was talking about things like they're still working on the exact sound mix for the Apocalypse vocal. So Oscar Isaac's character Apocalypse, that the way that he sounds is not yet finished, even for this trailer, and the movie comes out in a month. So let's hope it's finished in time. I'm sure it will be. But he said essentially the Wolverine appearance, Wolverine shows up, does something important, not something necessarily expected, and not necessarily something that takes a long time to do, but he has a pivotal role for whatever sequence he's a part of.
Hmm.
So I think that they would not call the character back in at this point, given that you did have, like you said, a very brief cameo in First Class. Then he carries the movie Days of Future Past. I mean, he is
entirely on his shoulders.
Future, past, everything in between. I mean, it's extremely dependent upon the Wolverine character.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So I would say to go back to a simple cameo would not be the right answer. They have to have him doing something significant. But, he's not going to be in the whole film. He'll be maybe a few minutes, maybe.
Yeah, and like I said, I'm hoping that there's more of a lengthy part of him involved in it, because it'd be great to see him more interactive with the rest of the X-Men universe, with the rest of the Marvel universe in that aspect for Fox. More than it's been previously, because honestly, the most we've seen is Days of Future Past, and as great as it was, I would still love to see you know, how part one and part two, how he was involved in that aspect with everybody. So
sure. The one thing that I wish they had shown in this trailer, because they have given a still image of it, is a character that everybody says, oh, well, that's the Blob. That's yet another iteration of the Blob. I wish they would have shown the character in action, though, because there's another character that Bryan Singer has mentioned as a bad guy that he would love to use someday. His name is Proteus. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the effects that are shown for, in this case, the destruction of Sydney, Australia. Previously, we've seen Cairo, I believe, affected. We've seen what looks to be New York City affected, where kind of all of the matter of the city is almost like dust being sucked up into the air somewhere. And, and everybody's assuming, well, this is Apocalypse doing this. And it very well may be. But this still image really compelled me because it does look like a version of the Blob, and it could be. It probably is. Mm. But this character, Proteus, in the comics, he's the son of Moira McTaggart, who's back in this film. In the comics, she's not a CIA agent, but in the films, played by Rose Byrne, she is. Works with the CIA. In the comics, she's a scientist. Mm-hmm. She has a son with another man, not Charles Xavier, and that son has an almost uncontrollable appetite. And what that appetite does is he kind of sucks reality in. If you can imagine, you know, the character of Kirby from video games,
yeah,
the way like that kind of effect, right? And he sucks reality in, and then he can kind of reconstruct reality out of like the building blocks of geometric shapes, quantum mechanics, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. And he becomes a very powerful, almost insurmountable villain. Bryan Singer has expressed interest in him before, indicating that he's not in this movie, but I was really hoping that this final trailer would show us that large man in action so that you could kind of see, okay, is this the Blob or is this the way that Apocalypse is destroying these cities?
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, maybe it's a mystery that they want to leave for another day.
And yeah, we'll definitely try to keep up the tabs with whatever else comes out with Bryan Singer. But that also brings us to our special presentation of our show. We actually have, like I said, a great topic in store. We're not only going to be talking about something that everybody has had on their minds for the last couple of months, probably even the years, but we have an in-depth thought as far as who we see as Captain America. And that's what we're talking about today. I told you to bring it around. There you go.
I was like, I'm looking at you across this table. I'm like, what?
That's right. We're going to be talking about Captain America, the First Avenger. And not only will we be mentioning the film, but we're also going to be doing an in-depth analysis of who we feel Captain America is, symbolically, theoretically, you know, psychologically. We're just going to really kind of take it apart and really understand it. A bit more and explain.
Yeah, talk
it to
a little bit about film structure. Talk a little bit about some of the stuff behind the scenes. Because, man, there's a lot of stuff to talk about.
With
anything in the Marvel universe, Marvel Cinematic Universe, but specifically Captain America, he's absolutely my favorite.
So yes, we were talking about 2011's Captain America, starring Chris Evans, Haley Atwell, Sebastian Stan, Tommy Lee Jones, and Hugo Weaving. So a quick synopsis.
And Stanley Tucci. And Toby Jones. And sorry,
there's really a whole
there's a lot of people in this
movie.
There's
a whole A-list of just top-notch actors and actresses in the film. You know, you gotta take what you can get. But a real quick synopsis. We got Steve Rogers, a rejected military soldier, transforms into Captain America after taking a dose of a super soldier serum. But being Captain America comes at a price as he attempts to take down a warmonger and a terrorist organization. Now, we were talking about this earlier, and of course, as we said, we've been really excited about Captain America Civil War. And so this film kind of is the foundation set for who we follow through as far as the films we watch, you know, with Captain America, the Avengers, and so forth. Everything that pretty much has Captain America in it, that we follow the evolution of the character. And so today, we're going to talk about the first film, The First Avenger, and how Marvel really portrayed this iconic comic character.
Yeah, because one of the things that I think is really unique about the Captain America sequence within the Marvel Cinematic Universe is that each film is very distinctive. You have it to a certain degree with, you know, Thor 1 and Thor 2, Iron Man 1, 2, 3. They're distinctive in the sense that they're different bad guys, like different challenges, but the supporting cast is largely the same. The way that the story is told is fairly similar. With the Captain America films to this point, and from the sounds of it, it continues with Civil War.
Yeah.
You have a very specific, almost like a snapshot. You have a specific type of story that's being told in each of them that certainly references the others, or leads into the others, but it stands alone on its own.
Yeah.
And that's especially true of this first one because it's set predominantly up until the very last kind of 10, end 15. Sequence, you know, the last 5 minutes or whatever. It's set in the 1930s and 40s.
Yeah.
40s, actually, not no 30s. Yeah, it's set in the 1940s. And so, you know, you have this kind of historicity aspect to it. There's a certain visualization that Joe Johnston, who's the director of the film, and his cinematography team and everybody, they really worked on making it feel of the time period that it's set in.
Mm-hmm. And so Captain America, Chad, because I don't know if most of our listeners know this, but Chad is, to my knowledge, probably the biggest Marvel historian that I know of as far as dating back with a lot of the comics, a lot of the history, a lot of the information that most people don't really know offhand when they go to see a Marvel film or they go to see an X-Men film or they go to see any type of, or even just talk about any type of Marvel-related hero or character or villain or any type of just character in general. And you tend to have a lot of great knowledge. So
random facts shoved into my brain.
Which is great for today because that's what we're going to talk about right off the top.
Sweet.
Who is ultimately Captain America? So we know Captain America as being Steve Rogers. Steve Rogers is this scrawny runt type individual who, through the course of the movie, you understand that he wants to be a part of the war. He wants to be in it because of the fact that he has a lineage who has spent time in war. And so he tries really hard and, you know, he ends up getting noticed by Dr. Erskine.
Who, Stanley Tucci's character.
Exactly. Who recognizes him as somebody who's worth investing into, worth seeing. But that's how the cinematic aspect. What about the comic? What are we looking at as far as comic-wise?
Well, I mean, the comics, he has a very, very similar starting point in the comics. The Captain America comics were created actually before America entered World War II.
Mm.
But Captain America 1 has a cover that is iconic and mm-hmm. very well known, where Captain America, this new character at the time, is socking Hitler on the jaw.
Yep, which is actually debuted in the film itself.
Which, yeah, it is kind of homage. There's an homage to it in the around the country kind of what is it? USO tours.
Yeah,
that he's a part of to fundraise, you know, for bonds and whatnot to support the troops and the military machine overall. In the real world, in the 40s. Captain America, absolutely, from moment one, from the cover of the first book before you ever even opened it, he was an adversary to Nazi Germany and to Hitler specifically. And this was before America was in the war. So, not that a comic book could be considered an act of war, but I mean, this at the time, this was the German head of state.
Yeah.
Right? And we have this new character that we're debuting who's punching the leader of another country. Now, granted, people understood that what was going on in Germany and the areas around it was not okay.
Yeah.
You know, but it's kind of a big deal when you come out with your opening salvo of a comic book.
Yeah.
You know, with such a strong statement. And I think that part of the reason why people do love the character and have loved the character for decades, generations by this point, is because in a way, as much as he has that patriotic idealism and all of the heartwarming characteristics, I mean, by the time he volunteers for this program, his parents have passed away. He doesn't have a whole lot going for him,
mm-hmm.
but he's got a lot of heart. And what I really respect about the film is that's kind of the place that they orient you to first. Everything that happens to Steve Rogers for the rest of his journey, no matter how long it carries, you know, through Civil War into hopefully Infinity War and, yeah. you know, wherever beyond. However long his story carries, that scrawny, runtly little dude with a big heart and all that hopeful idealism and right intention will always be there.
Yeah.
And I think that's what people love about the character, why he's lasted for so long, is because right from the first, you know, first go, before you knew his backstory, you knew that he wasn't going to pull his punches when it came to doing the right thing.
Yeah. And that's unique that you say as far as his entire career, as far as in Marvel, because there's a point where the paradigm does shift for Captain America in the comics. And this is not, this isn't even talking about the film-wise, the film that we're talking about, but sure. as far as comic-wise, there is a paradigm shift from his mindset to where ultimately the Golden Age was over at a certain point in time, and it's crossed over into the Silver Age for comics and for Captain America, and with that came, I believe, a shift for Captain America in his mindset as a character overall.
Sure. Well, there was a whole period of time where he was no longer a relevant character. He was... Superheroes overall were kind of deleted for a little while following World War II, and there were different types of comics being produced. You know, pulp magazines, you had some horror, you had some romance. But the superhero genre kind of was fading fast through the 50s especially.
Yeah.
And then in the 60s you reignite, and ultimately in the Avengers books they reintroduced Captain America from the 40s into the 60s.
Mm-hmm. So... with that, with the aspect of what this film shows, what the aspect of this film is trying to highlight as far as that comic career, how do you think the film did as far as presenting the origin story of Cap? How do you feel as a fan? Because I know you well enough to say that I don't know of any other comic book hero that you adore more than Captain America.
Quite as much.
Yeah. So how do you feel as a fan... how it presents? How do you feel about its Disney and Marvel's ability to present the origin story of Captain America?
You know, actually, it's funny that you said Disney and Marvel, because I was rewatching the film a couple days ago, and this was before Disney owned Marvel Films and Marvel Publishing, Marvel Entertainment overall. So this was actually distributed by Paramount.
Oh,
but it was a Marvel Films imprint movie, and. You know, from the get-go, I think that they've been very smart about honoring the key characteristics of these beings, these archetypal kind of characters. They've been, for the most part, very faithful to the origin stories. And, I mean, you got to understand, whenever you're talking about comic book characters especially, but any character that's been in the popular consciousness for decades upon decades... that origin story has been retconned and added to and taken away from and changed a number of times. You know, the basic is, oh, this guy that didn't qualify for military service went into a secret government program, took a super soldier serum, was zapped with some rays, and became really strong and fast.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and that was it.
That's my dream every morning that, you know, that happens.
You know, and then, right?
Oh, yeah.
Then over time, you layer in things like, oh, and when he did all of this, his parents were already passed away. He was a grown man, but an orphan at the same, you know, he was an orphan and he was now a grown man. You know, he was from Brooklyn and, you know, had kind of hard knock life and, you know, whatever. All those things get added later. Obviously, for the movie, we have the benefit of having all that content to pull from, the writers.
Oh, yeah.
I say we because I wish I was in that room.
Don't we all?
And they had all that stuff to pull from, and I think they really integrated it well.
Mm-hmm.
Even for as jarring visually as it can be to see Chris Evans, who plays Steve Rogers, Captain America, you know what he looks like in real life, let's say.
Yeah.
And for the first 30 minutes of the film, he's in this really small body. It looks very... his face on that body doesn't look natural because he looks like as an actor, and that's not him.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I think they did such a good job of driving home the heart of the character, his passion for doing the right thing, and his refusal to back down from bullies, all of them literally are bigger than him.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And, you know, his dedication to fighting the good fight overseas.
Oh, yeah.
All of that reads through, and I think that it really helps because at some point your mind kind of clicks over and says, okay, I'm going to believe what I'm seeing. So it's Chris Evans' face on a little body. But, man, this guy is just – he's already inspiring. I mean, he's doing things in super soldier basic training like, mm-hmm. you know, the grenade exercise. All the other dudes run away, and he jumps on what he – any of them think is a live grenade.
Oh,
and
yeah,
he says,
yeah.
get back. I'm going to take the hit for everybody, lose my life. And it's an instinct for him. It's an impulse. It's not a, I'm going to sit here and think about it for a minute. And then as the thing's going off, I might sort of, you know, try to protect these other dudes. He goes for it right away.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and I think that they did a marvelous job, no pun intended, really getting his characterization across strongly in that first 30 minutes of the film.
And you know, those, it's interesting that you say that because the film, the well, Marvel Studios as a whole, because now that I know, I actually didn't know that Disney was not a part of Marvel at the time, but now that I know, you know, whatever.
It was probably in the works.
Oh yeah,
it wasn't done yet though.
Paperwork is still being signed and everything, but it's unique that you say that because it's those qualities that they capitalized on as far as when they made this film, when they had in mind, we need to create a Captain America, not just any kind of Captain America, because there had been other iterations of Captain America previous to that. I mean, who wants to, you know, try to remember David Hasselhoff? No, not David Hasselhoff. There was another.
No, he was Nick Fury.
He was Nick Fury. Yeah. There was an 80s version of Captain America in a very
with the spandex.
Cheesy,
yeah. There was the motorcycle.
Yep.
Dude,
super cheesy. And,
yeah.
But for Marvel to come in and say, okay, we're going to do this and we're going to do this right. We're going to do it with, you know, just total, the mindset of total coming correct mm-hmm. to the character, you know, and like you said, bringing in the mindset of, because they could have easily went the cheese factor, they could have easily went with an already established type of Captain America, or they could have already came with the far off minded of having somebody super, super small and then having another actor who's super, super huge.
Right, just cast somebody different in the role, yeah.
But to be able to have this, first off, with the casting of Chris Evans, who can easily portray these type of ranges of emotions, and have him come in with the mindset that this is your role. You are a runt. You are a person who will be and has always been picked on. This is the mindset you have to have coming in. But you have a determination to make sure that, you know, you let people know you don't stand for bullies. And pushing that mindset, pushing the idea of what's beyond the American dream, you know, because everybody wants, you know, glory and whatnot. And that's kind of what the whole, in my mind, the original Captain America was kind of about. It was, the, you know, the stripes and glory and kind of deal. You know, stars, stripes,
yeah,
and glory.
Yeah, it was definitely not the American dream that you think of when you hear the word American dream. You know,
yeah.
Like the house and the car and the kids and the dog and the, mm-hmm. you know, all that kind of stuff. It was doing something that matters.
Yeah.
Like really, really matters. Something good, something right to counteract, you know, the evil in the world. Because that World War II era, that mindset, I mean, we don't call it the greatest generation for nothing.
Yeah.
You know, and Steve Rogers is very much a part of that,
mm-hmm.
that whole motif and paradigm of thought. He was created at that time in the papers, in the comic books. So, you know, you've got to honor that legacy and
oh, yeah.
that mindset. And the interesting thing you said, you know, talking with Chris Evans, the performer, about having that little guy against the bullies kind of mentality. He has actually said in press junkets since, I think as recently as Avengers 2, Age of Ultron,
mm-hmm.
where he still tries to make sure that he keeps that mindset in there, because regardless of kind of the updated, the new and improved Steve Rogers, the Captain America Steve Rogers, you know, with the physique and the abilities and, you know, whatever, the people pay him respect that they didn't pay him before. He's said before how he tries to keep in mind that the little guy, you know, if you grew up as this little runtly dude, you don't just lose that because you get a six pack and you grow a few inches taller and you can run really fast, jump really high,
mm-hmm.
and heal quicker than normal. It doesn't change the psychology of where you came from. And I find it really compelling that as a performer, he tries to keep that in mind when he's playing the character, because somewhere inside, all of the strength, all of the determination, and you know, the influence and the inspiration, all of that, somewhere inside is this little runtly dude who doesn't want bullies to get their way, and you know, may or may not have what it takes to stand up to them, but he's going to stand up to them anyway.
Yeah. And those are those attributes, those are those characteristics that I think really pushed Captain America to be an above and beyond type of hero film. Because we've had other ones. We've had other iterations of superheroes. We've had, you know, the Hulk. We've had, you know, with the X-Men and Wolverine. And we've had a lot of things before that. But when it came to Captain America, you had a rehashing of, not just a rehashing of an older character, older comic book character, but you had a reimagining. You had a almost like it was bringing it back to life and giving it even more of the freedom to be who he needs to be.
Yeah.
You know, and I thought those were really great ways that they were able, Marvel was able to really reinforce the film and reinforce the character in my mind.
Definitely. And it's interesting because you know, we've titled this lesson, introductory heroism.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting to think like that in this context with this character, that doesn't mean like introductory heroism as in as soon as he becomes Captain America, he is a hero.
No, he's a
hero from the very first sequence of when you see him in the film. I mean, mm-hmm. like he has that heroic quality. That's why he's chosen. That's why he's selected to undergo this process, because he's already a hero.
Yeah. And this goes back to the very first couple of scenes in the film when he's in the movie theaters and they're watching the newsreel before the cartoon or whatever is being played.
Right.
And they're talking about the troops overseas, just kind of a flashback to the film. And there's this rude guy down in the front who's like, come on, let's get to the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And there's women that are obviously who have husbands, boyfriends, fathers, brothers who are overseas fighting the war and that are upset by this, and they're crying from the newsreel. And this guy's just super rude. And
he's being a jerk.
But you see Steve, without even knowing what the guy looks like or who the guy is like telling him, you know, hey, shut up. You know, hey, have some respect.
Yeah. First he says, have some respect. And
yeah.
then he finally ultimately has to tell him to shut up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which leads to the first of many fights that we see Steve Rogers get into.
Yeah.
But it's pretty iconic how in those first scenes – you get a glimpse of seeing Steve Rogers, the withered Steve Rogers, in the midst of a fight, holding up that trash can lid and holding it like a shield. And we were watching a couple of weeks ago, we saw that Captain America, 75 mm-hmm. heroic years. It was a special that was on ABC. And they were talking about Stan Lee was talking about... when they went to go see the film, when they went to go screen it for the first time, and Jack Kirby was there. Jack Kirby got a chance to see it, and how everybody was anxious to have Jack Kirby see how Captain America would become, how Steve Rogers would evolve
sure.
into, and how excited he was, how when Steve Rogers grabbed the trash can lid and he picked it up and he was facing the guy and still had like intensity in his eyes. And you know, all they said, they remember saying, hearing Jack Kirby say, you know, turning back and just giving a big smile and a thumbs up, you know, being excited about it.
Yeah, one of the creators of the character.
Yeah, between him and Stan Lee, the original creators of the character.
Stan Lee came along later.
Stan
Lee was part of the re-emergence. He reintroduced Captain America in the Avengers books. Joe Simon. And I believe it was Joe Simon and Jack Kirby.
That's why you're the comic book goober.
Actually, it might have been Stan Lee and Jack Kirby. This is why I have a computer in front of me while we do these shows. Anyway, I know Joe Simon, and then it might have been Jack Kirby. Anyway, Jack Kirby was an extremely influential artist and storyteller for Marvel. Well, I don't remember what it was called before it was Marvel, and then for Marvel Comics. He worked a lot with the superheroes that we're very familiar with from Marvel. Fantastic Four, Avengers. I think he did some work with the X-Men. He bounced around it a lot in terms of creating kind of the iconic ones that we're used to.
And, you know, talking about how, you know, the creators and what they've come up with, we look at what Marvel's done with this character and we look at the structure of it and we look at it and we wonder, you know, going from A to Z, how the progression went. it begs to ask the question, you know, how faithful was it? How faithful was Marvel cinematically to the character structure of who Captain America is and how he's portrayed in this film? And I think that leads to you had a really great structure kind of example set up, and I think you wanted to...
Yeah, I mean, I've mentioned before earlier in this episode and on other episodes how I write for hobbyist purposes. I enjoy writing screenplays, and so I've studied a lot of how stories are put together effectively, and this goes beyond movie scripts and television shows and whatnot. This is just good storytelling. And one of the things that you find oftentimes, and you see in this film, you have your traditional three-act structure. Mm-hmm. Sometimes with movies, you get five acts now because they want more nuance, more tonal shifts somewhere in the middle. But this movie, it's got that that kind of historic old world feel and quality to it. So Joe Johnston, the director, he was known for movies like The Rocketeer, Jumanji, and a few others, you know, before this. They hired him very deliberately because they knew that he had that respect for the world of the 1940s, that he would have a visual aesthetic that would complement the content of the story. I think from a story perspective, it's incredibly solid. Typically, in a three-act structure, you've got your inciting incident in Act 1 that kind of... By the end of Act 1, you've had some form of a paradigm shift. In this case, you've got Dr. Erskine, who's played by Stanley Tucci. He's a German expatriate who used to do scientific experiments in Germany and now is in America working for a combination of American and British special forces, you know, government-type people.
The SSR.
The SSR, the Strategic Scientific Reserve, because he's a scientist.
There you go.
And so... He's influential in choosing Steve Rogers for this program. And so you've got that moment, of course, where little puny Steve Rogers goes into the machine. Howard Stark ups the electricity. They've got the serum in there, whatever. The power shorts out. The chamber opens. And you've got, you know, big, burly, hunky Chris Evans, you know, Captain America steps out, right?
And everybody wanted to buy that machine after that.
Right.
Install it in their home.
And in that sequence, you have... A Hydra agent, played by Richard Armitage, famous British actor, later played one of the main hobbits in the Hobbit trilogy, among other things. And he sets off an explosion. He steals the one remaining vial of super soldier serum, and he tries to make his getaway. And then Steve Rogers, you know, runs out in pursuit. So that's Act 1.
Yeah.
You've got kind of Steve Rogers, runtly dude with a big heart, does right, fights bullies, isn't afraid to risk his life on this experimental procedure.
Yeah.
And then, you know, his sort of mentor figure gets shot by the Hydra agent and dies, and then he goes and chases him down and destroys, as far as we know, the last remaining sample of super soldier serum in the world.
Yeah.
It gets broken on the ground. And then the Hydra agent kind of, you know, has one of those hidden cyanide capsules or whatever in their tooth. And he takes himself out. Then in a three-act structure, you've got Act 2 is typically some form of a descent into the underworld. And this comes largely from old mythological tales. Mm-hmm. Many people are familiar with Greek and Roman mythology. You also see it in Norse. And other paradigms. So here in this film, you've got Captain America. He does his kind of USO tour. He raises some money and he's feeling, you know, like he's not doing enough.
Yeah.
This incredible ability has been bestowed upon him and he's not doing enough. And so while he's touring overseas with the soldiers, he actually becomes involved in military action. And so he kind of literally, not kind of, he literally goes into the lair of the Red Skull. Mm-hmm. By the way, Red Skull, hello devil, right? the connection isn't hard to make, played by Hugo Weaving. So he goes into the Red Skull's lair in order to rescue prisoners of war, one of whom is his childhood friend, James Buchanan Barnes, Bucky Barnes, played by Sebastian Stan. And he goes to liberate them out of there, right? So he goes into the underworld for the purpose of a redemption, a restoration. And then in Act 3, in classically structured stories, you have either a subversion of the status quo or you have a restoration of the status quo. Mm-hmm. In Captain America, the First Avenger, you've got kind of both.
Yeah, yeah.
You have a restoration in the sense that, yeah, he defeats Red Skull. Red Skull kind of gets zapped into nothingness or zapped to another dimension by the Tesseract.
Mm-hmm.
We're not sure exactly what happens with him, except that Hugo Weaving doesn't want to play the character anymore. So he may be around,
happen.
He may not, who knows.
Yeah.
And in restoring that, in defeating the Red Skull, he also, Captain America, makes sure that the major cities of the world are not bombed by these, you know, this giant bomber that he's in, and he ends up crashing the giant bomber into somewhere in the Arctic.
Yeah.
You also, though, in Act 3 of this film, have a subversion of the status quo in the sense that our only status quo as viewers is Captain America himself. We followed him from moment 1 to moment, you know, 80 or whatever.
Yeah.
And now,
essentially, it's almost from 0 to the end, because essentially, in our minds, he died. If you're not
right.
familiar with the, if the storyline of the comics, you ultimately think, okay, this is the end of
he
that
hero.
He
sacrificed himself
yeah.
for the greater good. What's more heroic than that?
Exactly.
Right? Everybody gets that. A kindergartner gets that.
Mm-hmm.
A 2-year-old gets that. Everybody understands, right? But then they did that extra little next step
mm-hmm.
To let you know that that's not the end of Steve's story. And they have him wake up in the modern world. So we all feel better. Because we like the guy. But then he doesn't really know what to make of it. His status quo has been completely subverted because it's 70 years later.
Yeah.
It's not even the same exact world, the same New York even, that he's used to. And so it's interesting that they follow a classical story structure. And I would argue, on a macro level, they're doing this with the Captain America films as well. Where,
oh, yeah.
Whereas
without a
in
doubt.
The first film, by the end of that movie, he's in the modern era. He doesn't know it yet, but he's about to become leader of the Avengers, right?
The inciting incident.
So you've got the inciting incident, which is his whole kind of genesis and origin as a mm-hmm. hero, superhero. Act 2, which we'll get to next week in terms of the macro level, the mm-hmm. Winter Soldier, the second Captain America movie, that has this kind of descent into the underworld feel because, I mean, he's taking on the very organization that he's pledged to serve.
Oh, yeah.
SHIELD, because as we'll talk about next week, something's wrong.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
There's a funky smell up in there. And then by all indications, Civil War, the third Captain America movie, you have that are we going to restore or subvert the status quo? Now you've got heroes fighting each other over ideals and principles, because the society that they are meaning to protect no longer holds itself to the same ideals that someone like Steve Rogers expects. He just expects of himself and anyone wanting to lead people. He expects these things, and so his idealism drives him to make some very interesting, some might see them as uncharacteristic choices. So I think that the whole 3-movie sequence is following one giant three-act structure,
yeah.
If you kind of zoom out and see it from that point of view. So kind of cool.
And that brings us to the point of, you know, the idea of suspension of belief, you know, which is essentially a term that means you buy into what you see, what you hear, etc. So you know that there's something unrealistic or fantastical about it, but you don't let that knowledge hinder your enjoyment. So the big question is, knowing the storyline of Captain America and how this film plays out, do you believe it works with this film?
Oh, absolutely. Well, number one, suspension of disbelief happens in every movie ever,
mm-hmm.
every TV show ever. I mean, even if it's based on true events.
Yeah.
Something about, like, the story structure is deliberately stitched together to produce a response from the audience. So suspension of disbelief happens regardless of if you have people running around superpowers or whatever. In this case, I think it really does work because, like we said before, you know what Chris Evans looks like in real life.
Mm-hmm.
So in the beginning of the film, you see his face kind of shrunken a little bit and mm-hmm. stretched sideways or whatever on a smaller man's body. Real body, not a computer-generated body. It's an
yeah.
actual, like,
oh, yeah.
smaller physical human being, man. And they've kind of blended them together. And for a second, your eyes and your brain are telling you two different things. Like, that's not Chris Evans, that's not. But then your brain is starting to buy into the character. So I think that because they come on so strong with establishing his qualities, his characteristics as a human being, fictional human being, but a human being all the more. It's easy for you to quickly disregard what your eyes are showing you and just buy into the movie. And then when he becomes a superhero and he kind of, you know, grows and he gets his jumping and running and, you know, whatever, you've become so invested in the quality of his character that the superheroics, that's just cool. You don't have any trouble believing it, because it's almost as though with this character, him having those abilities means he's finally able to express the fullness of who he is and who he has been from the beginning.
It's a manifestation of everything that he, you know, expresses through his bravery and his courage and everything. It's the outward expression physically.
Definitely.
Of everything that he is within himself, which is all the things that Dr. Erskine finds, you know, and sees in him, and Peggy Carter sees in him, and, you know, so it's... I understand.
Which is not to say that there aren't aspects of the film that are a little more unbelievable. I mean, the Red Skull, his armada. I mean, he has, like, giant tanks. He's got medium giant tanks. He's got all kinds of other big vehicles. He's got special space weaponry, essentially, because he taps into the power of the Tesseract, thanks to the genius of mad scientist Arnim Zola. You know, so, I mean, he has some fantastical stuff going on that's a little less easy to look beyond. But for Captain America himself, I think that he comes across as very genuine.
Oh, yeah. And that's a very safe assumption with this film as far as the character portrayal. And as we said, you know, we're going to get more in depth into the next film in our next show. But before we get to that, that brings us to our special segment that we have called Fantasy Cast.
Now, we've done this bit once before.
We have, actually. We did it when we did our Batman versus Superman review, our spoiler and non-spoiler review, and we're bringing it back. And so the idea of what this segment is that we're going to take some well-known characters that are in Captain America, the First Avenger, and we're going to see what would be good alternatives to this.
Yeah, Mariah.
And the studio just turned into a dance party. Oh, yeah. You know, but all joking aside, you know, which, you know, honestly, there's no joking aside. We're all just all a bunch of jokers. But either way, you know, yeah, we're going to talk about a couple of these characters that, you know, you see them and you already know who they are as they've been established through the Marvel Cinematic Universe. You know, Tony Stark is portrayed by Robert Downey Jr.
Sure.
And honestly, you probably couldn't think of anybody else. You know, Captain America is portrayed by Chris Evans, and you probably couldn't think of anybody else.
Right.
You know, you have such iconic characters and you see them and instantly you know, okay, this actor portrays him because I've seen it for the last 8 years. So we're going to try as hard as we might to see who would we cast as alternates to the outstanding characters in the film.
So we're not touching the main.
We're not going to touch the main one.
Good guy, folks.
You know, because, you know, it'd be easy to kind of just shoot thoughts here and there. But honestly, I mean, with Captain America, I mean, if we really, really pushed it, maybe we could probably come up with something maybe next week or maybe the week after. I don't know.
The character of Captain America? That's a hard no.
That is well, yeah. But
I will not entertain the suggestion.
But we will hit a couple of key characters, starting with, this goes to Chad.
Yes.
Mr. Chadley.
Challenge me.
Who would you cast as an alternate to Bucky Barnes?
James Buchanan Barnes.
James Buchanan Barnes.
Best friend. By the way, you asked me a little bit earlier if this film is generally follows the comics.
Yeah.
I would say that the biggest difference between what the comics portray and what the Marvel Cinematic Universe portrays in terms of Captain America's story is the character of Bucky. In the comics, originally, during World War II, all the main characters kind of had sidekicks. You know, like Batman has Robin. great example, right?
Yeah.
Bucky was essentially Captain America's Robin. So Captain America was a grown man in the military, super soldier thing, whatever. And then Bucky was this teenage kid, like preteen teenage kid, wouldn't even have been old enough to enlist in the military, but was Captain America's sidekick, ran into all these huge firefights, and ultimately in the comics, he lost his life fighting the war. And so the filmmakers realized pretty early on that they can't tell that version of Bucky in these films. So they elected to go with somebody who was Steve's best friend from childhood, similar age, etc. Able to join the military and went overseas and fought, was ultimately captured by the Red Skull. So the characteristics, the arc of that character is different than what you see in the comic books. Now I'm done stalling because I finished thinking about who I would cast instead.
I'm gonna let him boil over this for a second. He's getting somewhere.
Sebastian Stan plays the character in the First Avenger, Winter Soldier,
Civil War.
He's actually contracted for a total of 9 films, so he'll probably be around for a while.
That might be too much Sebastian Stan.
However, if I were casting the role, knowing, because they did at the time, they knew that ultimately Bucky comes back as a brainwashed Russian assassin named the Winter Soldier. So knowing that I'd need somebody with some charm and charisma and camaraderie around the same age as Chris Evans's, you know, Steve Rogers, who ultimately then will turn dark and become an assassin, a brainwashed assassin, who could pull off that kind of a character arc, I think my vote would be for Casey Affleck, brother of Ben.
See, I don't know about that one, because as much as I see Casey Affleck as a great actor, I don't know if he can do Bucky. I don't know. You know, I've seen some of his acting as far as action-wise, but for me, it would probably have to be, and I was thinking about this earlier, it'd probably have to be Taron Egerton,
who would have been like 12
at the time.
He would have been like the Bucky of the comics.
Either way,
years ago, my
friend.
I mean,
you know, but you know, that would be my mindset. You know, that would be if I could put somebody who's currently,
he may have been 14, but yeah, he's not Chris Evans' age.
No, he's not. So, but that would be my mindset if I could put somebody
for Bucky Barnes. Okay, next question, and I apologize because this is worlds harder.
What?
Who would you cast instead of Haley Atwell as Peggy Carter?
Come on.
I know.
Seriously.
Who can imagine anyone else? She owned it.
Like, it's okay. So I'm a huge fan of Agent Carter, the TV show. I mean, we watch it religiously when it's on during the season.
She kicks some butt.
She really does. And to kind of just, I don't know, because you really have to pick. You have to really think about who could, to the level that Haley Atwell has done already for the character, who can rise to that kind of level. What kind of female actress could rise to that kind of level?
I mean, for crying out loud, she holds her own with Tommy Lee Jones.
Which,
that is no small feat. Who also, by the way, is not on this list, but he was one of my hands-down favorite performers in this film. Anyway, Haley Atwell. So, go back in time, right? When this movie was first cast, before it was made, and Haley Atwell was announced, very few people in America knew who she was.
That is true.
More people in England, because she's from England and she had done some, you know, some film work there. She was part of a mini series. I think it was called The Pillars of the Earth with Eddie Redmayne and a few other folks. I know I saw before she was cast in Captain America: The First Avenger. But go back and pretend like you've never heard of Peggy Carter. You've never heard of Haley Atwell. You just know that this is a female British special agent in the 40s. Who do you think might work?
Honestly, and you have to consider, because one of the big things that really separates Peggy Carter then, you know, from the rest of them is she's British. So you have to go across the pond to see what kind of, you know.
Yeah, because usually when you get Americans trying British accents,
you get horrible.
Not rendition. Good.
Yeah.
Now, British people doing American accents sometimes can do it really legit.
I don't get it. You know, look at Hugh Jackman. He's Australian, and the man does a better American accent than I do. I have a hard time just going through the whole entire process of going through our intro, for God's sake.
Totally agreed. Yep.
I got actually two people who I think.
Okay.
The first one is, and just bear with me, Emily Blunt.
Okay, who now, we know Marvel loves.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
she was almost cast as Black Widow, and then she had a schedule conflict, so they threw Scarlett Johansson in there instead, and they've talked for years about exploring her for various other roles, including Carol Danvers,
and Captain Marvel. I think Emily Blunt is... Well, yeah, that's true. Actually, you got to make a good point. She did... she was in the running for Captain Marvel. I had totally forgotten about that.
At some point, yeah. They still haven't announced an actor for that, an actress for that role, but she may or may not be in the running anymore, but she was one of the early choices when they were going to throw that character into potentially Age of Ultron.
Another woman I have in mind would be, and I have a habit of chopping up people's names, Gemma Arterton.
Mm-hmm.
She was in...
Hansel and Gretel.
She was in Hansel and Gretel. She was in...
Prince of Persia. She did one of the Daniel Craig Bond films. She was in very briefly.
She was also in Clash of the Titans,
I think. Yep, she was in Clash of the Titans.
So I
think, British.
You know, between those two, even possibly Jenna Coleman from Doctor Who. Jenna Coleman's a really great actress. She's actually played a role in Captain America: The First Avenger. She was Jenna. I don't know if you remember Jenna. It was small.
Was she one of the girls at the World Expo where they took him, you know, to the special presentation by Howard Stark, father of Anthony?
This one was hard, dude. Like, seriously. Okay.
Obviously, you came up with three. Who's your favorite, though?
Out of all three of them? So yeah. Here's my issue. Emily Blunt
has... Cue the Jeopardy music.
Do. Emily Blunt.
You. I want you to think about it.
Emily Blunt has the credibility of... being very action oriented. I mean, she's, you know, if you saw the movie Edge of Tomorrow, the one with Tom Cruise.
Yeah, something like that.
She's very action oriented. I
Live,
mean, she,
die, repeat.
That one,
I think, is what they changed it to for the DVD release.
Did
and
they?
It has it. It's a weird scenario. They had kind of both titles. It was odd.
But seeing the intros, seeing her in that, it really showed me that she has the chops. So I would probably have to go with Emily Blunt in that one.
Yeah, definitely. And oddly enough, and I'm not saying I would ever entertain this, but John Krasinski, who's married to Emily Blunt in real life from The Office, John Krasinski was one of the final few when they were casting Captain America. So in a different version of reality... you could have had a John Krasinski Captain America and an Emily Blunt Agent Peggy Carter, and they're married in real life.
What about...
which would make their online story all that much more tragic, because they don't actually end up together.
That would be tragic.
Spoiler alert, sorry.
What about you? Who do you think would make a good...
Oh, I totally agree. Emily Blunt.
Oh, Emily Blunt?
Absolutely, yeah.
See, I just... it's
She's
hard
a superstar.
Trying to... She really is. I mean, honestly, you look at her and you see...
Now, I have to say, though, she's too much of a superstar to be spun off into a
TV
winter
show.
TV show.
That's true.
Miniseries thing, and I'm really enjoying that show.
That is very true. But yeah, I mean, that's who I have to go with.
Okay, two more. We'll do these a little bit quicker. So, Eddie, if you were replacing Hugo Weaving as the Red Skull... especially now that we know that he didn't even like putting the makeup on and he won't play the character again because of how lengthy that process is, who would you use instead of Hugo Weaving as Megalomaniac Red Skull?
Now, you need to keep in mind somebody who has the presence and the verbosity, I guess, to be able to speak with such, you know, power and authority as Hugo Weaving just easily does.
So classically trained.
Yeah. I it would be between two people for me as well. Because one has always stuck in the back of my mind, but the mindset was, well, maybe he might be too young. I don't know. But the first one, though, he's been pretty much the bad guy in a lot of older movies. His name is Udo Kier. He's a German actor, which makes it easy for his dialect.
Yeah, he can pull off the accent.
Exactly.
Can he pull off the English?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, he can do that. He was the villain in the first Blade movie. And so I think he could actually really work. If not him, though, if we were going for a more, I guess, modern take, because if you have him grow the hair and make him look just right, I think Michael Fassbender could be a good...
Grow the Red Skull is bald.
No, I know, but when we've seen...
just messing with you.
When we've seen him like grow his beard out.
So you mean
and
young Magneto?
Yes.
Right.
But Michael Fassbender did a great German... a German portrayal in Inglourious Bastards.
Yeah, he's what, polyglot? Is that that's what they call it, right? When you speak multiple languages, polyglot. He's a polyglot.
So I mean, it's those guys are just in the back of my mind because, like I said, Udo Kier, I've seen him in just about every, you know, cheesy '90s movie that has just any bad guy they could find off the street. Not to say
so
that
so you
he's
picked
just,
him because he's German and he plays bad guys,
and he just seems very authoritative when he comes
I
into
see
the role.
Where this is going.
Well, okay, what about you? Who would
okay,
you pick?
Okay, I know exactly who I would pick. Another polyglot, Christoph Waltz, who was also in Inglourious Bastards.
Oh, there you go.
And several other Tarantino films, several other films in general. He's just a great performer. I don't think he had a great showing in Spectre. That's my personal opinion, and it has nothing to do with this film. If Hugo Weaving wasn't Red Skull, I think that Christoph Waltz would do a phenomenal job. And I think it would have been a much different performance than Hugo Weaving's performance because he does all kinds of weird, nuanced stuff. Hugo Weaving was a little more, I'm the Red Skull. This is the way that it is. I'm a bad guy. And yeah. I think Christoph Waltz might have done some more charming, gets under your skin kind of stuff.
The only thing, and we'll move on after this one, but my one thing though about Christoph Waltz is his frame. He's just a very small statured individual. I don't know how well that would have been portrayed as the, you know, just menacing look of Red Skull. But hey, you know, if it works, it works.
That's what the makeup's for.
Give him, you know, platforms and let him run around that way.
No, the Red Skull is not necessarily a tall person. Hugo Weaving is a tall person.
All right, all right. Well, you
read
know what?
Comics, Eddie.
We're gonna end off with this last one. Who would you pick to play Howard Stark?
Howard Stark, father of Robert Downey Jr. That's a hard one. That's really, really difficult.
Yeah.
I've already selected somebody for this, and I'm not entirely happy with it. We know he's got to be young so that he can have enough time to grow up and have a kid who would grow up to be the age of Robert Downey Jr. 70 years later. So I put Joseph Gordon-Levitt down just because he can play intelligent. He can play kind of ladies' man. He's done a couple of roles like that before. I'm not entirely sold on the casting, my fantasy casting. What do you think?
I honestly, so I was thinking about it and I'm like, you know, Howard Stark always seems more of the established mature gentleman, but not too old to where he's
in the
like,
40s?
Yeah. Well, okay. I mean, because then if you get too young, if you get too young, then
talking.
It just doesn't really
keep
make
talking.
Sense. So here's my mindset. I see the perfect alternate casting for Howard Stark for me would be John Hamm.
I knew you were going to say that. I would have said it for you.
Just because, I mean, he does a really well performance in just about anything he does as far as the range of motions and his ability to play a cheesy yet macho type individual. I mean, every time he comes out on set, it's always an offensive thing
and
to most
you know
women,
what
so.
I don't disagree that he would play a great Howard Stark. I think his age would have been a terrible problem.
But even then though, this film came out when 2011, so
no I mean the age of the character.
Yeah, I mean, if you shaved
him
down...
To have been 40 in the 1940s?
Do you not remember X-Men 3 when they did that thing with...
Oh, no. Well, you're done. Turn that mic off.
Yeah, that's our show for today. Right before we actually leave, we're going to leave you with a couple movie bites. First trailer for the movie Cell has John Cusack and Samuel L. Jackson in Stephen King's Tech Zombie Apocalypse. The trailer just released, and it is trippy for me.
It is weird. So instead of a virus, like a rabies type virus that makes people zombies, people answer their cell phones and it like scrambles their brains.
It's like
and they become zombies that way.
It's like a cellular version of The Happening, ultimately for me.
Yeah, we talk about movies on this podcast, so we'll probably go see it, but I could easily pass on this one.
As do
within
I.
the first like 4 seconds of the trailer, I knew I could pass on that movie.
I'm thinking the only selling points of this film are Samuel L. Jackson and Stephen King. But who knows? I mean, we just saw the first trailer.
Maybe it'll surprise.
Bryan Singer's 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea will be set during the aftermath of the American Civil War.
So Bryan Singer, who many people would know as the director behind most of the X-Men movies for Fox, he also did Usual Suspects, Apt Pupil. Yeah. He did a slew of Superman Returns for the other guys. So he's announced that after the newest X-Men movie, X-Men Apocalypse, he's going to take a hiatus from those films and do 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. And then he announced that he's going to make sure that it's set in the time period that it was originally set in, which is cool.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And if you're a great fan of the book, Bryan Singer has been one of those types of directors that has kind of been on point when it comes to doing films right when they have a great source material.
Absolutely.
So I have full faith that this film is going to really rock. We haven't seen a trailer yet, but I'm pretty sure when it comes out...
Well, they haven't started it yet, I don't think.
Oh, we'll see.
I think it's still in pre-production. It's greenlit, but it's in pre-production.
Code 8, a sci-fi film by Steven and Robbie Amell, destroys crowdfunding record. So apparently, Steven and Robbie Amell decided to do a crowdfunding campaign for their film that they wanted to do, a sci-fi film called Code 8.
Sure.
And it actually broke records after 30 days. I believe it broke it by 800%.
800%. So Steven Amell plays the Green Arrow on the CW show.
And Robbie Amell was Firestorm in the Flash series, television series.
And they're cousins in real life.
And so the film set out to make $200,000 and beat it by 861% with over 21,000 individual backers. It made a whopping $1,722,409 after 30 days. So I'd say it broke the record and then some.
Yeah, and it's got a really compelling log line or synopsis. If you check this out online, it's called Code 8.
Mm-hmm.
It has a really interesting premise, so
I'd
like to see it.
And finally, I don't have it written down, but I did get a chance to see it earlier. The Killing Joke, the animated feature that DC is putting out, released its first full trailer. So it's now online, so if you get a chance, go and check it out, having the vocal talents of Kevin Conroy and Mark Hamill.
Yeah, like definitive Batman voice and definitive Joker voice.
Oh, yeah. I'm super excited about this.
R-rated cartoon Batman movie.
And honestly, if you're going to do a Batman cartoon film, you know, to the fullest extent where it's going to get something like this, this is one of those cartoon films that you know they really didn't have a good either choice to do it. You know, you could have done a PG version or a PG-13,
yeah,
but you wouldn't have grabbed the full scope of the comic itself, the graphic novel.
Yeah.
So with that, you know, we want to thank you for listening to our show. And again, if you want to check out previous episodes, go ahead and check us out on our Facebook page at facebook.com/filmlosophers or our Twitter page at twitter.com/filmlosophy101. And as always, my name is Eddie.
I'm Chad.
Class dismissed.